One of the victims of the genocide in Rwanda was the country's legal system. Now, as the legal system tries to rebuild itself, it's faced with over 100,000 people who've been arrested for participating in the genocide and are now awaiting trial. My guests, Major Peter Sennett and Captain John Marley, are working as legal advisors to Rwanda's justice system through a project of the Naval Justice Academy. They were last in Rwanda in August. Sennett and Marley are in the U.S. Marine Corps Reserves and both work in private legal practices. When we invited them for an interview, they made it clear they were speaking for themselves, not as representatives of the U.S. military. I asked them what the odds are that 100,000 people will actually come to trial.
Well, the numbers that you'll see in most of the reports are that at the current rate they're going, we're talking anywhere from 300 to 400 years in order to process all these cases. So the current thinking is that somewhere down the line, this is going to break off, and they are going to pursue an amnesty panel, similar to South Africa's Reconciliation Commission. In all likelihood, they're going to narrow this down to prosecuting the worst offenders that they can identify, and then as the country continues to stabilize, they will make a move to pursue some kind of amnesty panel that will alleviate the remaining individuals being held for participation in the massacre.
Now, Terry, that's not without tremendous controversy, though, within the country. I mean, the Rwandan people themselves are not exactly pleased with what the international tribunals have been doing, the pace at which those have been going, and how few people have been brought to justice. The trials are taking outside of the country, and a lot of Rwandese citizens don't feel as though justice is being done to the victims of the massacre. And when people talk about letting people out of the jails and to relieve some of the crowding of being more selective in the prosecution, there are many people who are very upset, Rwandese citizens, not just people in the government, who are upset at the idea of letting people go who were involved in massacres because you can't try all these people.
Captain Marley, what are some of the basics you're trying to teach to people in the justice system in Rwanda now?
Well, Terry, we've worked with both military and civilian prosecutors in Rwanda, and I think any good prosecution starts with a good investigation and explaining that not only to the criminal investigators but to the prosecutors as well. For a long time, unfortunately, I think a lot of the criminal investigations began and ended with a confession. And, of course, any good prosecutor or investigator here in the United States would tell you that you need more than just a confession. You need corroboration. You need physical evidence. And sort of emphasizing that a confession is not a bad thing to have, but you need corroboration. You need other evidence. And having them understand that as a foundation for the prosecution. From there, taking them into opening statements, a theory of your case, what's your case about, building a case, what are the elements of the crime, and then obviously using witnesses, demonstrative evidence, the use of demonstrative evidence, charts and diagrams in court, for example, where a genocide took place, is sort of new to a lot of the prosecutors there.
What reaction do you get from prosecutors in Rwanda when you say a confession isn't enough?
Well, they smile at you and they want to know why. I mean, a confession is, in one way, sort of the strongest proof of guilt. But you explain to them that people can and will recant from a confession, that very often human rights organizations will accuse the government of extracting a confession improperly from someone, and it just is not as strong as evidence as it seems, and it needs to be corroborated if you want the trials to be fair.
Are you also having to teach people in Rwanda that you can't beat a confession out of somebody, you can't coerce a confession?
Oh, they're actually, I think, understand that pretty well. At one point during our discussion, we were getting into the distinctions between tricking someone into confessing, for example, telling them that we have evidence against them, which you really don't have, and actually coercing someone against their will. And they actually stopped me halfway through the class and said, "Excuse me, Captain Marley, but that's not correct. You should never trick someone into confessing. A confession has to be of their own free will." And they proceeded to lecture me about what the proper standard was, and were not willing to make such a fine distinction as U.S. law makes about perhaps deception to get a confession. So I think they have a pretty good idea of what their responsibilities are.
Where were they getting that standard from, that it's inappropriate to trick a confession out of someone?
Well, actually, I think they came up, they had recently received some training from an organization out of Belgium called Advocates Sans Frontières.
Lawyers Without Borders.
Right, which had recently given them some training in the criminal justice area. And there are some systems of justice in Europe and other places that don't make a distinction between getting a confession through trickery and coercion, whereas the U.S. Criminal justice system makes a distinction legally between a confession which you may have tricked someone into making, but is still not a coerced confession and is admissible in court.
What about teaching the basics of forensics? Is that going to be useful in the genocide trials?
They're very interested in forensics, and I don't know if it's because they were following the OJ trial over in Rwanda, but they have a great appreciation for and a great yearning to do more in the way of forensic evidence, whether it's blood analysis, DNA, fingerprint technology. Unfortunately, the state of affairs of forensic evidence in Rwanda, it's really back maybe about 50 or 60 years from where we are today. And that was one of the things that we tried in our training, to get them back to sort of a basics of forensics. I mean, you may not have DNA, but there are shell casings you can examine. A simple fingerprint analysis, hair and fiber, you may not be able to do with the degree of precision that we do in labs here in the United States, but you can make a persuasive argument from some very basic forensics.
I imagine a lot of the evidence against the people accused of genocide will be eyewitness accounts from people who were survivors and from people who watched and survived during the genocide. Are these people coming forward?
No, unfortunately, and that's exactly correct. Almost exclusively, the evidence is coming from eyewitness testimony. And unfortunately, in light of the fear of retribution from individuals who have not been caught or not in jail, the potential witnesses are very reluctant to cooperate, and those who have are very reluctant to give enough information that would lead to a successful prosecution. And there's quite a bit of documentation that you can find in the press of individuals disappearing or being attacked in light of the fact that they have spoken with investigators. And that actually has been part of the training that not only we have engaged in, but others as well, about how to go about taking a statement and how to go about obtaining information from potential witnesses without waving a big red flag that says you're from the prosecution team and you're talking to this individual and that individual in a particular village, because that in effect makes them a target.
So how would you recommend going about it?
Well, in a much more low-key manner, of course, that you're not taking the vehicle that's stamped, UN Office of Investigations or something like that, and driving right into the middle of the village and parking in front of the individual's house and walking in. And sometimes the investigators travel with military personnel as well if they anticipate taking someone into custody. Rather that, of course, you would try to establish a neutral meeting point or try to encounter an individual out on the street rather than going directly to their house or going to their place of work where they're going to be witnesses to this interaction between that individual and the investigator.
Mm-hmm. Have either of you been to the mass graves in Rwanda?
Yes, Terry, we have. We went to a school building outside of the town of Gikongoro, where a massacre, some people estimate over 25,000 people were killed there, of men, women, and children. They've disinterred about 9,000 or 10,000 people, and they're setting this school up into a national Holocaust museum. We went there back in September of '96 when they were still disinterring bodies, and the site is almost indescribable, of 8,000 or 9,000 women and children having recently been disinterred. It was really an awful sight.
When do you go back to Rwanda, and what's the next step for you there?
Well, we're hoping to return sometime this spring. That'll be contingent on funding of the program. And the next step that we're going to take there is actually still up in the air to some extent, because it hinges largely on the progress that they're making and the issues that they confront that are most topical for them. So what we actually get into will depend largely on what kind of feedback we get through our counterparts in the justice system there and through personnel at the embassy.
Captain Morley, any final words?
I'm optimistic. The people that we've worked with there, they have a keen sense of justice. And for them, that doesn't necessarily mean getting convictions on everybody or making everyone pay who they think was involved in the genocide. There have been acquittals. They do have a keen sense of justice and what's right and wrong. They want to do the right thing. There could have been an awful massacre in this country when the RPF took the country back and stopped the genocide. All those people who are now herded in prisons could have been themselves been massacred. And the fact that, although they are in some pretty horrible conditions, the fact that the country is trying to try these people and bring these people to justice tells you a lot about the Rwandese sense of justice. And I think the fact that they're committed to reconciliation of the country and bringing the country back together again.
Thank you both very much for talking with us.
And thank you very much.
Thank you, Jerry.
Captain John Morley and Major Peter Sinnott are working as legal advisors to Rwanda's justice system through a project of the Naval Justice Academy.